Elspeth said good night to the Duke at the end of dinner, leaving Matthew to see their guest to his car. Padraic had already arrived and was parked under the oak tree at the front of the house. Emerging from the car as they approached, he opened the rear passenger door for his employer.
"You and Elspeth are very good to me," said the Duke as he shook Matthew's hand. "It's not easy, you know."
Matthew wasn't sure how to respond. He wasn't quite sure what wasn't easy, and so he simply made a non-committal noise, something that could have been agreement or simply an acknowledgement of having heard. But if elucidation was necessary, it was provided by what the Duke said next.
"We live in difficult times, Matthew. Very difficult times."
Matthew felt he could agree with that. And yet, he reflected, people had always thought they lived in difficult times. He thought of his father's generation and his grandfather's before that. His paternal grandfather had lived through the Depression as a boy, at a time when the family had had very little money. Matthew had never known him, as he'd died before he was born, but he'd heard how hard it had been. Then there'd been the war, in which his grandfather had served with the Cameronians. His entire life, it seemed to Matthew, had been overshadowed by crisis and the moral disaster of war. Difficult times by any standards. And his father? He'd been born in the post-war period when, for a brief time, it looked as if the sunny uplands might have been reached. But then there had been the Cold War, and the threat of nuclear annihilation. His father had been 12 at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and even at that age had understood that at any moment the country might have been reduced to ashes. Difficult times again.
"Haven't we always lived in times of crisis?" he said to the Duke.
The Duke, about to climb into the car, pushed the door shut, indicating that he wanted to finish their conversation before he left.
"That's all right, Padraic," he said. "I'll just be a few minutes."
He turned to Matthew.
"You're right, of course. Every generation thinks its situation is uniquely worrying, but the world has always been on the brink of disaster." "Yes, that's right. But that doesn't detract from the particular difficulty of specific times."
He paused, appearing to think through the next stage of his argument.
"All that I'm saying, I suppose, is that there appear to be some periods where the dilemmas seem greater than those experienced a few years previously, or where there is a marked decline in something we value. That's what I was thinking about."
Matthew waited for the Duke to continue.
"It's the destruction of civility," said the Duke. 20 years ago, people may have had their differences of opinion. Of course they did. But they didn't abuse one another for it. They respected those with whom they disagreed. They spoke courteously."
Matthew was silent.
"Oh, I know that we shouldn't romanticize the past," the Duke continued. "And I don't, you know. But there are times when it seems that the social glue that holds people together is weakened and, well, brother is turned on brother, so to speak. My American friends report something very similar in their society. Friendships have been broken, families sundered because of the polarization that has taken place. Who can be happy about that? I can't."
"Nor I," said Matthew.
The Duke was right. He was talking about something that was there that had been noticed, and Matthew felt sad even to think about it.
"And now," said the Duke, "there's something very unpleasant on the loose. We may pretend that it isn't. We may deny it. But we know that there are more and more people who hate those whom they used not to hate. And there are even some who encourage this hate, who harbor that hate within themselves, and are happy to see it flourish in the breasts of others."
Matthew felt his heart beating hard within him. This was true. It was the uncomfortable truth that nobody wanted to acknowledge, to look at squarely in the face.
"I sometimes wonder," said the Duke, "whether this isn't because we started to dismantle nations. Nations gave people a sense of common identity and encouraged concern for others, because of the community implicit in the idea of nation. We started to chip away at that in the name of a wider transcendent identity, but But perhaps that hasn't worked, and as a result we've been cast adrift, our previous links and bonds dissolved or discredited, suspicious of one another, ready to distrust our neighbours. Hate is very easy to unleash, the Duke continued. All you need is the other, and then people will take over from you and do all the hating that needs to be done, all the belittling, all the insulting and bullying.
Matthew waited for the Duke to continue, but it seemed that he had said all that he wished to say on the subject. For his part, all that Matthew could say was, "I know what you mean." It wasn't much of a response, but it was accurate. He knew exactly what the Duke meant. The Duke reached to open the door of the car. Padraic brushed his hand away, though, and took the handle. The Duke looked at Matthew in the moonlight.
"Matthew," he said, "have you read what Hamish Henderson had to say in one of his poems? He says, somewhere or other, 'Let us not disfigure ourselves with hatred.' Let us not disfigure ourselves. How apt, how resoundingly true. We should not disfigure ourselves with hatred, Matthew, and yet we do. And dear Hamish Henderson, that softly spoken, good man, who believed that we should treat one another with gentleness and love, understood the dangers of that, and will be burling in his grave, Matthew, burling to hear some of the things that people say to one another these days." Matthew had not read the poem, but he had heard Henderson's great hymn to fellowship and sympathy, "Freedom, come all ye," and knew the sentiments. The Duke eased himself into the car. He wound down the window and addressed Matthew from within. "A final point, Matthew. We unleash these forces at our peril. A virus behaves in exactly the same way wherever you release it. Nobody is above it, and we are just as vulnerable as anybody else. That's why I'm sad, Matthew. That's why I'm sick at heart."
Chapter 32. Scouting for Boys, etc. Friendships between children often result in friendships between sets of parents. Conversations between waiting parents at the school gate do more than provide information on what is happening in the world of the school, and the latest gossip, of course. They may lead to exchanges of email addresses, invitations to dinner, games of bridge, and the negotiation of numerous playdates for the children themselves. Or they may encourage animosities and feuds. It wasn't at the school gate that Irene had come to know the mother of Bertie's friend, Ranald Braveheart McPherson. Bertie and Ranald were at different schools, Ranald at Watson's and Bertie at the Steiner School, but they were both in the Morningside Cub Scout pack that met at Holy Corner in Brunsfield. It was while they were waiting to collect their sons after the Cub Scout meeting that Ishbel Constance McPherson first met Irene. The meeting was not a success by any standards, and both women conceived a perfect dislike for one another, a dislike that subsequent acquaintance merely served to intensify. "I met an extremely ghastly woman this evening," Ishbel told her husband. "You should have heard her." "Loud?" "No, it wasn't the volume. It was the whole attitude. It's difficult to describe, but she was the sort of person one just couldn't help disagreeing with, whatever she said. You just wanted to disagree." "Oh, dear. Difficult." "And her son, little Bertie."
"Oh, he's marvellous," said Ranald's father. "I've met him. Very earnest. Very polite."
"That's him," said Ishbel. "He has to put up with this train crash of a mother. He deserves a medal."
These cold relations hadn't been improved by a famous telephone call between the two mothers, in which salvos had been fired from Scotland Street across the rooftops of the old town to Church Hill, and then returned with interest. But although they were barely speaking to one another, both were compelled by their son's friendship to negotiate times to drop off and collect their offspring from the other's house on those occasions when the two boys met. So when Ishbel came that day to drop Ranald off for a play session with Bertie, she rang the Pollock doorbell somewhat gingerly, as if prepared to receive from it a reproach or even a minor electric shock. Irene knew who it was at the door and was determined to wait as long as possible before she answered.
"I think that might be Ranald Braveheart Macpherson at the door, Mummy," said Bertie.
"Ah," said Irene, "you think, Bertie, but do you know that it's Ranald at the door? How can you be certain?" Bertie looked puzzled.
"Because it's 3 o'clock, Mummy, and that's the time that Ranald said he'd arrive."
"No, Bertie," said Irene, "one shouldn't act on mere surmise. I've often told you that, n'est-ce pas?"
Bertie looked down at the floor.
"I can't remember, Mummy, but I..."
Irene interrupted him. "That person at the door, Bertie, might be an unsolicited caller. We wouldn't want to encourage them, would we?"
She paused and then continued.
"Shall we see whether the person rings again? If she does that, then we'll know that it might be a genuine caller, possibly even Ranald Whatnot."
"Ranald Braveheart Macpherson," Bertie reiterated, just as the doorbell sounded again.
"Well," said Irene eventually, "perhaps now we can go and investigate, and who knows?"
And here she raised her voice as they had reached the door. "And who knows what manner of surprise awaits us?" Bertie opened the door to reveal an irritable-looking Ishbel and a beaming Ranald.
"Hello, Ranald," he said brightly. "I told Mummy it was you, but she said we were to wait."
The frown on Ishbel's forehead intensified. A weather forecaster, interpreting it as a meteorological map, might have used the words thunder, gathering storms, and ice.
"I hope we didn't disturb you," said Ishbel.
"Not in the slightest," said Irene. "And here's young Ronald. How nice to see you."
"Ranald," muttered Bertie.
"Not Ronald, Mummy."
"Of course," said Irene. "How silly of me. And Isabel, how are you?"
"Ishbel," whispered Bertie.
Ishbel spoke through gritted teeth.
"Very well, thank you. Just catching my breath, though, after all these steps. I must say I admire you living in a tenement. It must keep you all so fit. All these funny little stone steps every day, up and down."
Irene's eyes narrowed.
"Of course, you don't have that in suburbia, do you? I suppose that's quite comfortable, but I must say, give me Georgian proportions any day, steps or not."
Ishbel smiled sweetly.
"So, here's Ranald all eager for his play session with Bertie. Shall I come back in about 2 hours?
"Perfect," said Irene. "Bertie has to go to his yoga around about then."
"Yoga!" exclaimed Ishbel. "All that stretching and posturing."
"Positioning," corrected Irene.
"Of course, positioning."
Bertie decided to take control.
"Let's go inside, Ranald," he said. "I want to show you something in my room."
"Good idea," said Ranald Braveheart Macpherson.
The two boys went off, leaving the mothers facing one another for a moment. With an icy smile, Ishbel turned to leave.
"A bientôt," said Irene.
Ishbel turned around.
"What?" "A bientôt, French for see you soon."
Ishbel muttered her way down the common stair.
"Common stair," she whispered to herself, and felt a great deal better for the remark. Once in his room, Bertie showed Ranald Braveheart Macpherson his contraband copy of Baden-Powell's Scouting for Boys. They examined diagrams relating to the positioning of tents and the making of a campfire.
"I bet Mrs. Baden-Powell made really good fires," said Ranald.
"Yes," said Bertie. "He never used matches, you know. He just rubbed sticks together over some tinder, or he sometimes used a magnifying glass to focus the rays of the sun."
"He was jolly clever," said Ranald.
He looked at Bertie.
"You know something, Bertie? My mummy hates your mummy. Does yours hate mine back, do you think?"
Bertie looked thoughtful.
"It's difficult to tell, Ranald. You know how grown-ups are. It's hard to work out what's going on in their minds."
Ranald Braveheart Macpherson nodded.
"I asked her once why she hated her, and she just smiled and said that everybody did."
"Everybody did what?" asked Bertie.
"Hates your mother," said Ranald. "I'm really sorry about that, Bertie. It can't be easy having a hate figure for a mother."
"Let's not talk about it, Ranald," said Bertie. He looked out of the window.
"You see, you can't change the mummy you get, can you? You have to accept her."
Ranald looked at his friend with admiration.
"You're very good at that sort of thing, Bertie," he said.
Bertie looked more cheerful.
"Thanks, Ranald. So, let's go to the Drummond Place Gardens and play Walter Scott."
Chapter 33. In Drummond Place Gardens. Given permission by Irene to go out to the Drummond Place Gardens, provided they didn't wander off anywhere else, Bertie and Ranald Braveheart Macpherson made their way through the narrow garden gate into the world of luxuriant shrubs and towering trees that made up the handsome green retreat. Like most of Edinburgh's private gardens, this was a quiet, rather staid place, crisscrossed by walkways and dotted here and there with benches from which to contemplate the Rus in Urbe. A small sign saying "Authorized Dogs Only" dissuaded lesser dogs, or their owners perhaps, from intruding. Another sign saying "No ball games, shouting, or otherwise behaving improperly is permitted under any circumstances" made it clear that these were gardens in which a certain standard of decorum was expected. Yet this wasn't enough to deter two small boys, away for the moment from the adult gaze, from starting an exuberant game of Rob Roy, in which they took it in turns to be Rob Roy, a hairy and frightening Highlander, whose main purpose in life was to chase after the other boy, who represented the settled, cattle-owning classes of Scotland. If Rob Roy caught his quarry, he had to be able to hold him for the count of 10, whereupon he gained 1 point. On reaching 3 points, that Rob Roy won the round and the whole thing started again, rather like Scottish history, in which some things seem to go on forever, and indeed sometimes started all over again. It was when the game was at a particularly crucial stage that Angus Lordy, exercising his dog Cyril, turned a corner and was cannoned into by the two breathless boys, one wielding a stick designed to represent a claymore, and the other doing his best to evade capture.
"Whoa!" shouted Angus. "My goodness, this is a frightening scene I stumble upon. Pirates, corsairs pursuing an unfortunate Sicilian, the Zulus chasing redcoats."
The boys stopped, panting to regain their breath.
"I'm Rob Roy," said Bertie, "and Ranald is one of Montrose's men."
"How very interesting," said Angus.
"Walter Scott wrote all about it," said Bertie. "Have you heard of him, Mr. Lordy?"
Angus smiled.
"I believe I have."
Bertie knew about Walter Scott from a visit to Abbotsford, Scott's boarder's home, that he had made with Ranald and his parents a few weeks before. Irene had been reluctant to let him go, being dismissive of Scott and his oeuvre, describing it as both romantic and reactionary.
Stuart, however, had taken Bertie's side, and eventually he was allowed to go. For the two boys, the trip had been one of unadulterated excitement, their imagination being fired by the towers and turrets of the great writer's home. And the interior was every bit as exciting as the exterior, with its displays of the historical relics that so fascinated Scott. The coats of arms of Borders families, displayed around the entrance hall, spoke to Scott's abiding interest in matters heraldic, and were gazed upon with fascination by Bertie and Ranald.
"Macphersons have got that stuff," said Ranald proudly. "Our clan has a cat and a glove as its crest. I don't suppose you've got one, Bertie."
Bertie looked disappointed. He didn't know whether he was so entitled, but Ranald's father came to his rescue. "I'm sure the Pollocks have got their own family crest," he said, "and even if they don't, Bertie could make one up."
"You could have a picture of a sword," said Ranald, "and perhaps a lion, because you're jolly brave, Bertie."
"Thank you," said Bertie. He wasn't sure that his mother would allow a sword, or indeed a lion, for that matter. He rather feared if she had anything to do with it, and she would certainly want to be in charge, he would end up with heraldic devices rather different from those on display in Abbotsford. A yoga mat, for example, or a picture of Sigmund Freud or Carl Gustav Jung. It wouldn't be a crest one could display with any pride. After they'd finished their tour of the house, Ranald's mother announced that she had packed a picnic in the back of the car and they would be able to have this in a spot in the woods to the west of the house.
"I saw a rather attractive spot," she said, "and you boys can do a bit of exploring afterwards."
The picnic basket retrieved from the car, the Macphersons and Bertie made their way up a gently sloping brae towards a cluster of broadleaf trees. Finding a suitable picnic place, they laid out a tartan picnic rug, and on this placed their picnic hamper. Vacuum flasks of hot water were used for tea, while for the boys there was iron brew, the sickly orange national drink of Scotland's youth. This was a great treat for Bertie, to whom iron brew and all other sugary drinks were normally strictly forbidden. Ishbel knew this, of course, and for this reason said,
"Don't forget to tell your mummy about the iron brew, Bertie. I'm sure she'll be really interested."
It was a delicious thought, and both Ishbel and her husband exchanged amused glances.
"That'll give her something to think about," whispered Ishbel. "She's such a good fascist."
"I don't really approve of iron brew," said Ranald's father. "The next generation risks turning into a tribe of puddings. I fear that iron brew is not the best thing for them to be drinking."
"Of course it isn't," said Ishbel. "I know that. But the point is to get right up her nose."
Ranald's father understood how tempting that might be.
"Very satisfactory," he said, savouring the thought. "But what astonishes me is that Stuart puts up with it. Where's his backbone?"
"All worms eventually turn," said Ishbel, "even the mildest ones." While this conversation was taking place, the boys had drifted off and were scrambling around in the undergrowth not far away. And it was from a clump of brambles that a cry came.
"Are you boys all right?" shouted Ranald's father.
Back came the reply.
"Yes, but we've found something."
Ranald's father rose to his feet. He would go and investigate, because it crossed his mind that boys guddling about in the undergrowth could find anything, and it might be something unsavoury, possibly even a body. That, after all, was how Scandinavian noir dramas started. A body was found by a walker or a child or even a dog. The innocent stumbled across the corpus delicti and gave a shout, just as Bertie now did. Chapter 34. A Significant Spurtle.
It was Bertie who saw it first, sticking up out of the ground, half-hidden by a trailing sprig of bramble. Gingerly, avoiding the thorns, he pulled back the bramble, while Ranald Braveheart Macpherson peered at the half-exposed piece of blackened stump.
"What is it, Ranald?" asked Bertie. "Do you think it's a bone?"
"Could be," answered Ranald. "Maybe it's an arm. Or a bit of an arm." He gestured to his forearm.
"This bit here, see? Maybe the fingers have come off."
Bertie bent the bramble back upon itself so that they could both get an uninterrupted view.
"I think I should dig it out, Ranald," he said. "Then we can find the rest of the body." "What about the germs?" asked Ranald. "There could be tons of germs around here, Bertie."
Bertie considered this. "I think all the flesh is gone, Ranald," he said. "Once all the flesh drops off..."
"Or is eaten by worms," interjected Ranald. "Most of it gets eaten by worms, Bertie. That's what happens, you know."
"I know," said Bertie, "but I think this is a really old arm, Ranald. I think this goes way, way back, and there'll be no germs or anything left." He paused.
"But if you like, I'll start pulling it out, and if anything happens to me, you can run and get help." "You're very brave, Bertie," said Ranald. "Tofu says that you're scared of things, but I don't think that's true."
"Tofu's a well-known liar," said Bertie.
"You can say that again," said Ranald. "His pants will catch fire one day, Bertie. All those lies he's told will catch up with him. And boy, is God going to punish him when he eventually gets hold of him."
Bertie had now moved forward and was crouching alongside the strange object. Reaching into his pocket for a handkerchief, he wrapped this around the top of the protrusion and gave it a gentle tug. The earth in which it was buried was dry and loose, and it didn't take long for the thing to become free, bringing with it a small clump of attached soil. Bertie brushed this off with his free hand while holding the top of the object with the handkerchief.
"I think it's wood," he said. "I don't think it's bone."
He brushed more soil away.
"No, Ranald, this is a bit of wood. It's not an arm or anything like that."
Ranald Braveheart Macpherson looked disappointed.
"It's a pity it's not a body," he said. "It would have been really exciting to have found a body, Bertie. We could have taken it to school to show people."
Bertie didn't reply. He didn't think it likely that his mother would allow him to keep a body in the flat. There were so many restrictions in his life, and that was just one more of them.
"It's a piece of carved wood, Ranald," he said. "It's a stick, maybe a batten. Look at this."
Bertie pointed to a small round bobble at the top of the stick. As he polished it with his handkerchief, the shape became more recognizable.
"That's a thistle, Ranald. You see that bit there? That's the smooth bit at the top of the thistle."
Ranald had spotted something.
"And down there, Bertie," he said, "there's some writing."
Bertie looked at the small carved letters pointed out by Ranald. Peering more closely, he read out M.R.
"Mr. Somebody?" asked Ranald. "Could that be the name of somebody who owned this?"
Bertie looked doubtful.
"If it was Mr., there would be another name."
He examined the stick again.
"But there isn't."
Ranald wondered whether it was a ceremonial wand of some sort. Bertie considered this and was about to answer when Ranald's father appeared and asked them what they were doing. Proudly, the boys showed them their find.
"We thought it was a bone," said Ranald to his father, "but it's really a
"That looks rather like a spurtle," said Ranald's father. "You know what a spurtle is, don't you?" Bertie did.
"It's something you stir your porridge with, Mr. Macpherson."
"Precisely, Bertie. And should we go and show that to somebody in the house, just to see whether they can throw any light on it?" The two boys followed Ranald's father back into the house, Ishbel having tidied up the picnic things and taken them back to the car. In response to Ranald's father's request to speak to somebody about a find, one of the custodians said that James Holloway, chairman of the trust, was in the house, and they could speak to him.
James arrived and examined the spurtle carefully.
"Where did you find it?" he asked.
Bertie explained, and James listened attentively. Then, addressing the two boys, he said,
"This is a very important find. These initials here, M.R., stand for Maria Regina. And this, boys, could well be nothing less than the lost spurtle of Mary Queen of Scots."
Bertie drew in his breath.
"You mean..."
"Exactly that, Bertie," said James. "The place where you found it is the spot where Sir Walter Scott used to like to have picnics. He possessed Mary's spurtle, but it went missing. He must have used it on a picnic and then dropped it by mistake."
"The spurtle wasn't heard of after that," continued James. "But then, in 1975, there was this article about it by Professor Sandy Fenton, published in the Scots Magazine. That raised interest in the subject, but nobody knew of its whereabouts until quite possibly now."
Ranald's father was visibly pleased.
"This is quite wonderful," he said. "You boys have made a great discovery."
"We shall, of course, evaluate it further," said James solemnly. "But in the meantime, a small reward is payable to both of you."
James reached into his pocket and took out a £1 coin for each of the boys.
"Thank you very much, Mr. Holloway," said Bertie, pocketing his reward.
Ranald echoed the thanks.
"Who would have thought it?" said Ranald's father.
He glanced sideways at James, who smiled. Ranald's father understood. He knew that the world was a place of wonder and excitement for 7-year-old boys, as it was for the rest of us, if we were willing to open our hearts to things beyond the things we see, and if that sense of wonder could be enhanced and made to last just a little bit longer, then why not? The world was a vale of tears. Who could doubt that? But there were moments when the tears might momentarily be wiped away.
Chapter 35. Mission Statement. While Bertie and Ranald Braveheart Macpherson were explaining the rules of Rob Roy to Angus Lordy in the Drummond Place Gardens, in their flat in 44 Scotland Street, Irene and Stuart were discussing their plans. The campaign to which their strategy related was Stuart's application for promotion in the Scottish Government's Department of Statistics. When Stuart had first revealed to his wife that a senior vacancy had opened up and that he, along with two colleagues, was a candidate for the promotion, she'd given him her support without hesitation. Irene was not interested in the activities of the Scottish Civil Service, and had even less interest in statistics. What motivated her, though, was the higher salary that went with the post. The Pollock household may not have been on the breadline, but with only a single income coming in, Irene did not work. Their budget was a tight one. The new position, Irene learned, had a salary that was £20,000 a year higher than Stuart's current point on the pay scale, and that, in her view, clinched the matter. Stuart needed the job, and she would do whatever she could to help him get it. Stuart had explained to Irene that there were two other applicants, both of them current colleagues of his in the department, and both, in their individual ways, insufferable. Irene had listened to his description of Elaine and Faith and his account of their shortcomings. She agreed that neither had particularly attractive personal qualities, and that Elaine's inability to do long division would be a serious drawback. But she felt that she had to tell Stuart that, notwithstanding these drawbacks, the other two candidates had a major advantage.
"Whatever you may think of them as people," she warned, "don't forget that they have one formidable advantage."
Stuart tried to imagine what this would be. Perhaps what people said about Faith was untrue. Perhaps Elaine really could do long division if given enough time.
"Can't you see it?" asked Irene impatiently. "It's very obvious, you know."
"I'm sorry," said Stuart. "I can't.
I'm trying to think positively about them, but frankly it's beyond me.
Irene sighed.
Really, Stuart, you're being a bit slow on the uptake, if you don't mind my saying so. It's chromosomal, I'm afraid.
Now it dawned on Stuart what Irene's point was.
You mean, they are at an advantage because they're women?
Irene nodded.
They are both women and therefore entitled to the job. So you are battling against a major handicap right from the start.
Stuart frowned.
But surely the job will be allocated on merit.
Irene smiled.
Yes, it will be. Women candidates are more meritorious. It's as simple as that.
Why?
Irene gave him a discouraging look. That's just the way it is, Stuart. It's to do with historical injustice. It's to do with hidden male networking. It's to do with the persistence of patriarchy. Take your pick, but in essence it means this. You are not as meritorious as they are because, well, you're a man.
But that's outrageous, said Stuart. Why should I be punished because I happen to be male?
Irene made a dismissive gesture. That's just the way it is, Stuart. We can't reopen that issue all over again. Learn to live with it.
Stuart bit his lip.
So, said Irene, let's get down to work. You said that you had to submit an essay in which you set out your stall, so to speak.
Yes, said Stuart. It's to be my vision of what I think about the issues facing the department, and what are the values I would try to assert if I were to be appointed.
Irene listened carefully. I think I know what to write.
Stuart stared at her.
But I'm meant to write it. It's meant to be from me.
Oh, Stuart, that's the merest formality. You can have an input, but I know what these people are looking for. You must let me handle this.
This last injunction was made in a voice that Irene used when she was giving a final and definitive ruling on some domestic matter, and Stuart knew that it was futile to argue. This was Irene speaking ex cathedra, and with an authority only slightly eclipsed by the authority with which the Pope issues an encyclical on some matter of dogma. Irene took the form from the folder in which she had filed the application papers.
"Here we are," she said. "You had better write it out in your handwriting, Stuart. I'll dictate."
"I'm ready," said Stuart.
"Very well," said Irene. "Now, note this down. I shall begin. I believe that I, that is you, Stuart, am the right person to take forward the implementation of the department's goals on transparency, accessibility, inclusiveness, stakeholder involvement and consultation, and rectification of historical imbalances."
Across the paper scratched Stuart's pen, committing Irene's prose to the official form before him.
"As a department, we must seek to implement in the most cost-effective and productive ways the goals of ensuring that vertical job stratification should be conclusively and convincingly neutralized. For this reason, I would support a policy of non-shortlisting of male candidates for any future vacancies. I would further support and seek to implement a policy affording existing male employees to leave prematurely, either to pursue alternative careers in the catering / service sector, or to take early retirement."
Irene paused. This was very good stuff, she thought, and it would tick the boxes that she knew would need to be ticked if Stuart were to succeed, in spite of the obvious handicaps of gender, against the weight of opposition against him.
"I think that might be enough," she said. Stuart looked doubtful.
"Shouldn't I say something about my educational background?"
Irene shook her head fiercely.
"Certainly not, Stuart. Not when you have the background you have."
"Middle class."
Irene sniffed. "Yes," she said. "That would be fatal. I suggest you say nothing about that, and nothing about the years you spent working for the PhD. The last thing you want to sound is elitist, and PhDs are elitist by their very nature."
"But you're going off to Aberdeen to do one," protested Stuart. "What's the difference?"
Irene looked at him with ill-concealed pity. "Oh, Stuart, the fact that you need to ask that question in fact precludes my answering it. Only an elitist would ask that, I'm afraid."
Stuart gritted his teeth.
"Don't they want applicants to be highly qualified?"
Irene looked at him with a cool directness.
"They don't want the typical highly educated male. They don't want him to come in with all his baggage of assumptions. They don't want that, Stuart. They certainly don't."
Stuart decided to concede. He'd conceded throughout his marriage, right from the very beginning, and he saw no reason why he should try to change now. He was defeated. Irene was right, as always. He should trust in her in exactly the same way that a pilot trusted his instruments in fog. He should trust her absolutely and not try to do things himself. And in the background was the thought that this was not forever. Irene would be going to Aberdeen one day. Oh, blessed, blessed day on which our freedom dawns at last.
Chapter 36. She wanted a man so desperately.
Pat McGregor looked out of the window of her Marchmont flat. By standing in one corner of the room and craning her neck, she had a view of the meadows, of the trees that lined Jawbone Walk, and of the skyline of the old Royal Infirmary beyond that. Jawbone Walk was rich in associations for her. As in her student days, now a few years behind her, it had been along that path that she made her way into the university each morning, to Professor Thompson's lectures on French art that she so enjoyed, or to the tutorials on Scottish painters of the 20th century, or to the cups of coffee with fellow students in the cafeteria of the university library when everything and nothing would be talked about with a passion and certainty that comes so naturally at that stage in life. Now, of course, she was not so sure. The world and its issues seemed so clear-cut then because almost everyone about you, or at least your coevals, held the same views, and if only those in authority would stop being so mean and grudging and agree to the things that people were asking for, then everybody would be so much happier. Couldn't they see that? What perversity of spirit stopped them from acceding to such patently reasonable demands? And then, almost imperceptibly at first, the realization came that the world was not as simple as one imagined it to be, and that there were choices to be made, and that not everybody was benign. The truth then dawned that there simply wasn't enough for everybody to have what they wanted or needed. That everything was finite, and that what one had taken for granted had actually been paid for by years of work by somebody whom one would never know, who might never have been able to enjoy any of it anyway. Her university days had been carefree. A generous father had supported her through her course, not only paying her rent, but giving her a monthly allowance as well. Other students had to sign up for student loans, large sums that hung about their necks on graduation like albatrosses. The bill for 4 years of privilege. Pat didn't have that, and felt guilty about it. Then, on top of everything, Dr. McGregor had bought her a rented flat when the landlord put it on the market, cashing in savings to pay the exorbitant purchase price. Now she lived rent-free,
courtesy of her father's kindness, and used the rent paid to her by her two flatmates to cover living expenses. Topped up by the part-time salary Matthew paid for her work at the gallery, she'd enough to live on reasonably comfortably. She realized, though, that this was not how life would be forever. In particular, she was beginning to feel vaguely irritated at having to share the flat with two other young women. Her flatmates, Bernice and Andrea, were tidy enough in their habits, and in objective terms, no trouble at all. They paid their share of joint expenses without demur. They never left washing up in the sink. They scrupulously avoided eating food Pat left in the fridge. That last matter was the cause of so many rows in shared flats, cheese wars that raged for months over who had encroached on whose lump of cheddar. There had been none of that, thank heavens. And yet... The problem with Bernice, Pat felt, was a certain lack of, and here Pat faltered. What exactly was it that Bernice lacked? Was it engagement, or intellectual curiosity? Whatever it was, it had begun to annoy Pat, who marvelled that anybody could be as passive as Bernice was in the face of things that really should have produced some sort of reaction. Bernice had a boyfriend called Terry. He was an IT man with a finance company, a slightly flabby young man whose nose Pat had never liked. She knew it was wrong to judge a person by his nose, but in this case, that is what she did. Terry's nose said everything that needed to be said about his character. It was a dull, directionless nose. It wasn't the sort of nose, she thought, that could ever point anywhere specific. It would wander about like a weather vane in shifting winds. It was a pointless, dispiriting nose. When Terry visited Bernice, which he did on most evenings, the two of them would sit in front of the television and watch endless pre-recorded programs about home improvements. There would be no conversation, although Terry would occasionally make a comment about somebody's choice of kitchen units or paint. "Can't stand the colour," he would say, or, "I wouldn't choose green, would you, Bernice?" And Bernice would say, "No, not green, Terry." And then there would be silence, until sometime later Terry would remark again on some point of decor and say, "They'll regret that, you know." Pat couldn't stop herself from speculating about Bernice and Terry's love life, and once or twice these thoughts came to her unbidden while the two of them were sitting watching their home improvement programs. Unfortunately, the thought made her want to laugh, and there was an embarrassing moment, for Pat at least, when Bernice turned around and said, "What's so funny, Pat?" Andrea was quite different. While Bernice was overweight and rather bovine in her manner, she was petite, and showed a lively interest in the world about her. What annoyed Pat about her, though, was the large social chip she carried on her shoulder. Andrea came from a large Catholic family in Airdrie, and she clearly resented what she saw as Pat's privileged Edinburgh background. "It's all very well for you," she once said, "but you don't really know what it's like." "Excuse me," said Pat. "I don't know what it's like." "Real life," said Andrea. "Why?" Andrea smiled condescendingly. "You live in Edinburgh. You went to that stuck-up school. No offence, but you did. You don't know what it's like to live in Airdrie." Pat defended herself. "But what's wrong with Airdrie?" "There you are," said Andrea. "You don't know." The argument stopped there, but it left Pat angry. Nobody likes to be condescended to, and to be condescended to by Andrea, who had, after all, chosen to leave Airdrie and come to live in Edinburgh, was more than Pat could bear. She decided that she had had enough of this. She simply didn't want to share any longer. And that meant that she must get rid of these flatmates and replace them with a man. She wanted a man. She wanted to come home to one person, one male person,
and sit together and watch programs that were not about home improvement. She wanted a man so desperately. "I want a man," she thought. "I really want a man." And that man was Bruce, for, quite against her better judgment, she was falling for Bruce again, and she knew that this was a disaster, even if she yearned for him terribly. She was aghast at what she was being drawn into by some weak, irrational part of her, yet she couldn't stop herself. That sort of attraction, anarchic in its effect, seemed irresistible, overcoming all intellectual reservations, all scruples. And here she was, standing by the window, waiting for him, because he had said that he would come and see her to discuss his project. Every minute weighed heavy upon her. Every minute increased her desire. Chapter 37. A Visit from Bruce. When the doorbell rang, Pat stayed where she was at the window, counting backwards with painfully slow deliberation. It was something she'd done since childhood, using the countdown to prolong the pleasure of anticipation of some treat. Counting down from 50 to 1 and then to the 0 of fulfillment increased the pleasure of the reward. But now she did it so as not to appear too eager. He wanted to rush the door, but wouldn't. For all her eagerness to see Bruce, it would be better to give the impression that there were other things to do before admitting him to the flat. Now she stood on her side of the door, took a deep breath, brushed her hair from her forehead, and then reached for the handle. "Bruce!" She stopped herself just before the vowel would have given everything away. "I almost gave up," said Dr. McGregor. "You took so long to answer. Daddy, aren't you going to invite me in?" She stepped aside, trying to hide her confusion. "Of course." He entered the small hall that formed the heart of the flat. "I was walking past," he said, putting his hat down on a chair on top of a half-open bill. "I thought I might pop in for a quick cup of coffee, if you had the time." She looked at her watch. "I was planning to go out." She didn't like lying to her father, and her voice sounded strained. "I won't stay long," he said. 10 minutes or so. "I wanted to talk to you about your grandmother's pictures. I've been thinking we should do something about them." She invited him into the kitchen, where he sat down in the chair that he always chose when he visited her. As with most of the furniture in the flat, it had come from the family house in the Grange, this one from his study. When he'd given it to her, he told her that he had thought some of the best thoughts in that chair, and perhaps she would carry on thinking them for him. She filled the electric kettle with water.
"Granny's pictures?"
"Yes, the ones in the attic. Remember I showed them to you, 5 or 6 of them, all gathering dust?" She nodded.
"Yes, you said that you couldn't find a place for them on the wall."
"Exactly. Unless I put them in that spare bedroom at the back, the one we never use."
"You could do that."
She glanced surreptitiously at her watch. Her father was the last person she wanted to have in the flat when Bruce called. His dislike of Bruce was intense, and she knew that he would be dismayed if he knew that she was seeing him again. She loved her father deeply and would never wish to hurt him, but her feelings for Bruce were... well, they were not her fault. That was it. They were not something she had chosen. They were like a bad cold or flu. They had simply happened. You don't choose to have flu, and you don't choose to fall for Bruce Anderson, or a man like him. Her father watched as she ladled coffee into the cafetiere.
"I don't want to tuck them away where they'll never be seen," he said. "Your grandmother was very fond of them.
She knew him, you see.
She knew Adam Bruce Thompson, the man who painted them. I think that some of them were birthday presents from the artist.
I see.
He fiddled with a placemat on the table before him. There was a small yellow stain of congealed egg yolk on the mat, and Dr. McGregor picked at it idly.
That was Bernice, thought Pat.
She'd been making an omelette for Terry, and she'd spilled some of the mixture. Terry loved cheese omelettes, which had put Pat off them now. Dr. McGregor abandoned the placemat and looked across the room at Pat.
I've decided that it's wrong to keep things like that in the attic. If you have something that other people might like, I think you have a duty to let them enjoy it.
He paused. What do you think, Pat? She'd been thinking of what she would say if Bruce arrived while her father was still here. Could she express surprise, or would that be insulting to her father, who would see through the pretense? Or should she say to him, right now, Bruce is coming to see me. He has a scheme. She could tell him about Bruce's scheme, but that would probably just make matters worse, as he would worry about her involvement in anything to do with him. After all, he'd once said to her, that young man is toxic to you, darling. Toxic. She struggled to answer his question.
What do I think about keeping things in the attic?
Yes. I suppose it could be selfish.
Yes, I suppose you're right about that. We couldn't sit on things that other people might enjoy.
He nodded. That's my general view. But then, I've been trying to square that with the whole notion of private property. If you carry that sort of approach to its logical conclusion, then you would end up believing in a fairly radical redistribution of just about everything. I wouldn't be allowed to live in my house in the Grange, for example, because there's just one of me and it could accommodate 6 people. The example was as extreme as it was personal, but that, he thought, was where tyranny lay. A tyranny that would not allow people to live in their own houses. Pat shrugged.
It's a question of degree, isn't it? Really large discrepancies in what people have are wrong, but there'll always be some.
I don't think you need to worry. Not yourself. And Granny's paintings, well, you could probably put those in an auction if you were feeling really guilty about them, which I don't think you need to. It's not as if you were a terrifically rich fat cat, Daddy. You're just...
The bell rang.
Are you expecting somebody? Asked Dr. McGregor. Pat stood quite still. A way out had occurred to her. She could simply not answer. Bruce would ring again, no doubt, but after a while he would assume that she had forgotten he was coming and had gone out, or he might think he'd got the time wrong. Her father was looking at her.
Aren't you going to answer?
She made her decision, and she shook her head.
Mormons, she said. They came yesterday at about this time, and I put them off. I said I couldn't talk to them, and they could come back some other time. That's who it'll be. And I just can't face them right now. I can't face saying no to those clean young guys and seeing them look disappointed and trudge off downstairs again. I just can't.
Dr. McGregor smiled.
They do tend to be very well scrubbed, don't they?
The bell rang again.
Do Mormons ring twice? He asked.
Always, said Pat. It's part of their training. There was silence for a moment, followed by a brief hammering on the door.
Do the Mormons do that?
Pat's gaze was fixed on the ceiling.
They can be persistent, he said.
Chapter 38. An Invitation to an Encounter. In his studio, a short walk from Scotland Street, Angus Lawley settled behind his easel, his palette on a table beside him, the paint upon it small extrusions of freshly squeezed colour. The smell of stand oil and turpentine hung in the air, a smell as suggestive as that which pervaded